From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how lighting the Hone Bridge could bring unity in a time of divisiveness. Then we learn about a new poetry anthology called Through This Door, Wisconsin in Poems.
And when Peggy was floating this idea, Ronnie Hess, who was the chair at the time, said, there's never been a collection with every single Wisconsin poet laureate together. That seemed like a perfect opening, right? That was a door opening right there.
Plus, Daniel Golden of Boswell Books joins us for our yearly Books to Gift segment and says one book is especially relevant today.
Imagines the life of Shakespeare's family. And one of the interesting things about Shakespeare is that he lived through, to give it a parallel today, he lived through the plague.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukeeans have come together to celebrate and memorialize one of the city's iconic structures. The Daniel Hone Bridge is dedicated to the longest-serving socialist administration in U.S. history. The long-awaited Light the Hone project finally became a reality in October. Dan Steininger is the grandson of Hone and has been raising money to light the Daniel Hone Bridge. He plans to have the lights coordinate with events and moments Milwaukeeans can rally behind, like every time the Packers score a touchdown. Steininger speaks fondly of his grandfather and everything Hone accomplished in his life. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about his hopes for the bridge to be a symbol of unity and what the city can accomplish at a time of divisiveness.
Dan Hone was a very unique character. I was lucky enough to grow up with him when I was a young man. He lived with us out in Wauwatosa. So I probably spent a good 15 years of my life knowing Dan Hone. Wish I would have been a little more politically acute to ask him hard questions, but nevertheless, it was wonderful to be around someone like that. And when we would go downtown, visit Milwaukee, people would say, hi, Mayor. And I got to thinking, hey, maybe he really was a mayor. So anyhow, he grew up, his great-grandfather was a Civil War veteran who moved to Waukesha. And then that's where Dan Hone grew up. And they were very sympathetic to the working class of America. We have to go back to the late teens and the early 20s, even before that, to know that capitalism was rampant. We were growing a great economy. The problem was workers were abused, whether it were average workers, women, children, unbelievable hours. It was an economic downturn. People lost jobs. It was no cushion, nothing to help them. That's the environment he grew up in as a very poor person. He did graduate from UW's law school. UW undergraduate, Kent Law School in Chicago, and came back to Milwaukee. And eventually was talked into by the Socialist Party and running for city attorney. So he became the city attorney. In that capacity, he helped draft the first workman compensation law in the country. None existed. So Becca, if you or any of your listeners were ever at work, think about it. If you get injured on the job, you know, going to work, trying to do your best job, you get injured. Injuries always happen in work environments, regardless of how hard people try. You were just out of luck. Not only did you lose your wages, you lost your job and maybe never work again, condemned to poverty. So that workman comp law that he drafted as city attorney became a model for the whole nation. After that, in 1916, he ran for mayor on a socialist ticket and was elected. And so in his administration from 1916 to 1940, spanned 24 years, he introduced programs like, they called him a sewer socialist because he built sewers in this city, many of which are still usable today, that cleaned up the mess that was sewage in our streets. As a result, the health of the citizens improved. And every year, Milwaukee would win the award as the best, healthiest city in the nation. Until the ranking people finally said, look, could you not apply anymore? No one else can win. He felt people who worked should have the opportunity to recreate on weekends. And he developed one of the most impressive park systems in the nation called the Green Belt around Milwaukee. and where every citizen could go to a park on the weekends and enjoy the outdoors, which is so good for their health. That park system was eventually sold by Dan Hoan to the county, and now we have a county park system, but it was all generated by Dan Hoan. I remember going to the lakefront with him when I was a little boy, and he pointing to this lakefront saying, the lakefront belongs to the people. So fast forward to today, and we know one thing. We have a Hoan Bridge, and we know that most people don't know who Dan Hoan was. So that got me to thinking, well, you know, you have a great political leader in Milwaukee, and our citizens don't know who he is. I think another part of this whole bridge lighting is the opportunity to bring the community together. Dan Hoan stood for the idea of every citizen counts, every citizen should be respected and given an opportunity to grow and achieve their full potential in life. So that's the kind of character he is. And I think the more Milwaukeeans learn about Dan Hoan as we light this bridge, the more they're going to appreciate their history and the contributions he made to their current life. And everyone can celebrate the opening of the bridge together as a lighting event that will forever change the skyline of Milwaukee.
Coming from that legacy and knowing that history, what is it like to see the divide in our country right now?
It's sad, really. In many ways, it's sad. It doesn't need to be. And I think here's where Milwaukee, and it's too bad, we've taken so many blows as a city. We lost the Democratic Convention due to COVID. We love our baseball. We can't go to baseball games. Even the Milwaukee Bucks can't play here. Here's an opportunity for our city to prove to the country and its own self that we can do something really positive. So the governor, the mayor have been very supportive. Some of the leading, and this is so interesting, business leaders have stepped up to make this happen. Now, these are capitalists, unbelievably successful capitalists who are contributing time and talent to getting this bridge lit. These are what have historically been known as great capitalists are donating, you know, their time and talent and money to make this lighting possible. And there you go, bringing people of all backgrounds, of all income status together around a symbol of this city's unity. And I think this could start a very strong feeling that Milwaukee can get something done. It can do it as a community, it can do it together. And more importantly, prove to the world that this city can take its blows and come back fighting.
It seems like there's renewed interest in socialism. What would your grandfather, who was the longest serving socialist administration in the United States history, think of capitalism today?
There's a misunderstanding on everybody's part of what socialism became. Dan Hoan, initially was a socialist, to call for, because of the abuses of capitalism, government ownership of private business. Well, the socialists concluded early on that wasn't going to happen and sort of abandoned that. In fact, Dan Hoan, toward the end of his life, when I was living, became a Democrat, the Socialist Party virtually disappeared. Socialism represented an attempt by government officials to put the people first, create a safety net for people, give them the opportunity to achieve in life, because not to worry about whether they got injured on the job, not to worry about retirement because of Social Security, not to worry about unemployment in the way that you ruined your life if you lost your job. Those are the things that the socialists believe in. And everyone can agree to that. I think it was a mistake about the whole dialogue is to use socialism as almost a dirty word. When in fact, socialism was really when it evolved into what can we do to create and provide a safety net for people to live a decent life. Things like, instead of saying socialism's health insurance, no, people have a right to have basic health insurance. Who wants to go to bed at night knowing a child's life is in danger because you can't go to see a doctor? You have no opportunity to do that. I think I will blame many of the candidates for allowing the word to become demonized and a bad word. And in fact, when it was one of the great accomplishments of the last century, socialism saved capitalism. FDR took the ideas of the socialist and implemented them in the New Deal. That saved capitalism in America. That's what people like Karl Marx, who was a communist, never could grasp, that you could actually take a capitalist country and implement some of the ideas and the safety net of the socialist and provide a much stronger economy. That's what they never thought about. And so we can thank the socialists for that heritage. And while the party has basically disappeared, the ideas live on through the candidates. So with that, this represents a great opportunity to recognize the contributions of our mayor, Daniel Hoehn, and the socialists to basically saving capitalism and securing better lives for all of our citizens. So it is a unique opportunity in our city's history to become a symbol to the nation that when things are tough, we get tougher. We can beat the problems that face us. And we do it by caring for our fellow citizens. So that's what this bridge will represent when it is officially opened on October 22nd.
What would your grandfather think of this project and your reasons or motivations behind doing it?
He wasn't an egotist to worry a little bit about his place in history. He just spent his time helping his fellow citizens. I think he would really, really enjoy it because first of all, he's instrumental in getting the harbor. That bridge spans the north and the south. The ships coming from all over the world go under that bridge. I think he would love the notion of symbolically bringing the community together. That bridge symbolizes that. I think he would enjoy the fact that Milwaukee has become a booming economic powerhouse, getting more so in the last decade or two from being really, really a distressed city. And I think he would appreciate the fact that this bridge represents the community's effort of people coming together. He would definitely applaud the idea of it's creative, it's interesting, it respects all of our community. And I think he would be very proud to have his name attached to the bridge and this the symbolism of this lighting where every citizen can let their light shine. That song should be the theme song for this bridge.
What does it feel like to be doing this project, further memorializing the longest socialist administration in United States history at a time like this?
In life, things you learn as you grow older. When you look back at your life, and anybody, and this is true of all your listeners, the things that you will remember most are not your high achievements, but when things were really hard and what you did to get off the mat. And when I go to hire people, I always look to see, how have you been knocked down in life? What troubles have you faced and how did you overcome those troubles? This city has taken its hit. We lost corporate headquarters, bleeded businesses to other parts of the world all through the 80s and 90s. We're now on the comeback and it's a big comeback story. And this bridge, I think, can capture, despite the loss of the conventions, the sports and everything else, here we are in the middle of a pandemic, lighting a bridge, symbolizing the community's effort to overcome a real tragedy. So I think that's going to be one of the most enduring messages that this bridge achieved through private donations into the millions, lighting that bridge in a time when we were really distressed and we were really down. And that will be always part of that story, how a city back in 1916 was an embarrassment to the nation, became by the 30s one of the greatest cities in America. This bridge can celebrate that history, that success story of Milwaukee. And we're back on the rise and and COVID and everything else happened and racism can all be overcome if this community has a collective effort. And that's what this bridge will represent. So that's pretty exciting.
What has the response from the community been?
Well, really, if you think about it, go to the website, literally hundreds, maybe thousands now have put their dedication on that website. So anyone can go see the dedication by their fellow citizens. Wow, what a community effort at a time when no one really knew what would this look like. I think once, now they've had a preview, people were pretty much stunned. They had no idea how active that lighting would be, how the colors would change, the patterns would change. People really didn't grasp when they made their contributions just how amazing this was going to be. It will be such a draw and such an interesting part of our city and its skyline, forever changing it. And the downtown is booming, high-rise office buildings and residential have risen. They'll all be able to see it every night. what a great amenity for those living in our city, living downtown, traveling over the bridge every day. And that's very, very exciting.
Daniel Steininger is the grandson of Daniel Hone, whom the Hone Bridge is named after. He spoke with Lake Vex Becca Schimmel in October about the Light the Hone project. Now, just as the Light the Hone project was supported by the Milwaukee community, here at WUWM, we're supported by you as well. And supporting WUWM doesn't just mean supporting the news you depend on. It also means supporting the news and programs your community depends on. You hear the difference your gift makes every time you listen to WUWM. Now you know what a powerful gift you're giving to your community as well. Today is Giving Tuesday, so give a gift that you know keeps on giving. Go to wuwm.com/give, call 877-583-0309, or tap the red donate button in the app to make your gift today. Thank you. After the break, we'll return with Wisconsin Poet Laureate Peggy Rosga and Madison Poet Laureate Angie Trudell Vasquez to talk about a new Wisconsin poetry anthology. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo wrote, quote, "When beloved sun rises, it is an entrance, a door to fresh knowledge." This quote served as an inspiration and a call to action for Wisconsin Poet Laureate Margaret Rosga. She, along with Madison Poet Laureate Angie Trudell Vasquez, co-edited a new poetry anthology called Through This Door, Wisconsin in Poems. From literal to metaphorical doors, the poems serve as a way to see Wisconsin through the minds of all 8 Wisconsin Poets Laureate, plus City and Regional Poets Laureate, to make a racially and geographically inclusive book. Grouped into 4 sections, each poem reflects memories of the past, struggles of the present, and hopes for our future. Peggy Rosga and Angie Trudell Vasquez join me now to tell us more about Through This Door, and Vasquez begins by explaining how they put the anthology together.
So I feel like every piece in every section builds on the prior. It's not like a true arc, I think, but all the poems have a conversation with one another. And when we started getting a lot of poems in, I wasn't reading them all because I wanted the poems to have a conversation in my head. And Peggy said, "That's spoken like a true editor," which I think is a compliment. But I think it's really important. And then as we would select a piece and put it next to something else, other things would open up. So, you know, there is a lot of artistic creation that goes into putting a collection together. There has to be a flow and a balance. And I think we did this really well. Peggy mostly put together the first section, and when I was tinkering with it, I remember you saying, "Peggy, this I'm feeling very committed to this first section, but I feel like the second, third, and the fourth collection, things just worked well together. We'd get a new poem, and we didn't realize we had a gap that poem filled." And when you, Audrey, do a collection and you send a call out, the universe gives you the poems you need for that collection. And it's really serendipitous, but it's also kind of like a beautiful thing that the universe gives back to you.
I was wondering if we could hear one of the poems that kind of encapsulates this idea. Peggy, would you be able to read Margaret Newton's Rising Sun and say a few words about it?
I would love to read that poem. We were so happy that she agreed to let us include this poem in the anthology. For a couple of reasons. One is I think it speaks to the theme that comes through in Joy Harjo's quote very well. The title of the poem, the English title of the poem, Rising Sun, directly relates to Joy Harjo's words, "When beloved sun rises," although they were not written directly in response one to the other. Margaret Newton also writes in the Ojibwa language, Anishinaabemowin, and I would really love to be able to read the poem in that language too, but it's beyond my skill level. So I'm going to read the English. Rising sun. The sun never really rises. We only ride Earth toward that force and energy and then rotate away. We never really teach. We tell measured stories morning to afternoon, summer to winter. We never really break. We fall back in the crashing waves to stand up once again, not seeing how we've changed.
So this anthology includes works by all 8 Wisconsin poet laureates, as well as city and regional poet laureates like yourself, Angie. I'm wondering, has this ever been done before, specifically with all Wisconsin poet laureates? And did you seek out each poem specifically, or did you make this collection based on submissions you got? Did you have to leave anything out? What was the process of collecting these?
Well, both Peggy and I were at the meeting for the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission, and I am the, I guess, the vice chair is the proper term for the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission. And I should back up and say, Peggy and I have done some projects before, and I have a small press, very small, Art Night Books. And when Peggy was floating this idea, Ronnie Hess, who was the chair at the time, said, there's never been a collection with every single Wisconsin Poet Laureate together. That seemed like a perfect opening, right? That was a door opening right there, as we would say. And when I came in, I said, well, yes, I would love to be part of the project. And then it grew and it kept growing. And there was a lot of curation, Andre. We didn't just take everything. We had to look at what was submitted and really figure out how they work together. Yeah, there were some hard decisions and we did have to turn some away. But I also feel like every poem in here was selected for a reason, you know, and that's really important.
It evolved in the course of my doing workshops. One of the first workshops I did as Poet Laureate was with the students of Vincent High School. And I used a poem from my book, 200 Nights in One Day, about an African-American couple that tried to rent a lower flat. And they're turned away because the owner doesn't want to rent to African-Americans. And I asked the students, is that door now open? That door that was closed in their faces, is that now open? And we talked about that for a little bit. And then I asked them what doors they had closed on them, or what doors had opened for them, or what doors they closed on others or opened for others. And then they wrote, and they wrote some really fine poems. Their teacher, Jennifer Koss, gave me copies of the poems, but with first name only. So although I really loved some of those poems, by the time this first inkling of a project became a project, those students had moved on. I didn't have last names. I couldn't get permission to use those poems. And I was doing other poetry workshops around the state and found that the other kinds of responses that I was getting sometimes opened other doors and went in different directions. And so one of the things that I thought from the beginning was that I didn't want any one voice to predominate, that I wanted the poems to play off against each other. And there was a professor at Madison College, professor of design, who wanted a project for her class. So she asked Wendy Vardaman if she knew of a chapbook in progress that her students could work on. And Wendy said, how's that project that you're working on coming along? So we quickly put together a chapbook size, roughly 25 pages, that the students could work with. They were from some of the workshops that I had done around the state. And at this point, we had asked various poets laureate from around the state, local and regional poets laureate, as well as prior state poet laureates, to contribute poems. And what we said was that we had this theme of door, a door opening. Send us something that relates to that theme. It can be literal. You can actually mention a door, but you don't have to. And that brings us to the point that Angie talked about, where at the meeting of the Poet Laureate Commission, we decided to go bigger, to do a full-length book, and to really honor the people who had been building a poetry community in Wisconsin in one way or another.
Right, and the subject matter of these poems, as you mentioned, Peggy, ranges from literal doors to metaphorical. There's topics ranging from the current pandemic we're facing, midterm elections, common poetry themes. Angie, I was hoping you would be willing to read your own poem featured in this book called What and That, and if you could say a few words about it before you read it aloud.
Sure. So this poem, What and That, comes out of my own investigation and my fourth collection on the history of humans, which I'm very interested in. So there is some science in here. But I see this as, who are our ancestors that opened the door for us to live in the way that we do now? And in some religions, there is a corn woman, right? And so if you start researching anthropology and archaeology, and even looking at like the history of grandmothers and their role in our development as a species, there's a lot in there. And it's theorized that a woman was the first one to figure out how you grow corn. So that's all in this poem. And I will say, Audrey, you know, we have our favorite foods. Well, I've got favorite poems. And this is currently my favorite poem of mine, which might seem a little, I don't know, not humble, but you know, you have favorites, right? Like your favorite pets, you know, or favorite trees. So this is my favorite poem. And there's music in this. It's called What in That. What woman picked the corn, split the husk, and molded the seed that fed the people and opened the world? What being climbed down the tree, made the savanna a refuge? Who caught the strike that lit the bush, that started the spark, that became the flame, that lit the hearth, and traveled village to village, hollowed horn of smoldering smoke that started the fire, that cooked the kill, that fed the self to grow so big? What worker birthed the child, cut the cord, swaddled it, and kept on going down her row? What mother walked thousands of miles with two hands held in those smaller than her own? What father carried his child over mountaintops, swam through rivers, crossed deserts and lakes with one arm? What prisoner pierced the lock, walked out into the sunshine? What grandparent let her daughter sleep while the child rose, bathed its skin in rose water and lavender, sang songs of ones and twos until it cooed back, ohs and ahs blowing bubbles? What woman picked the corn, split the husk, and spilled the seed that fed the people and opened our world?
Thank you very much for sharing your favorite poem with us. It was a treat to hear you read it because, you know, you read this as someone coming in, whether you read poetry regularly or you're a novice, and what you interpret could be completely different from your cadence, you know, your vision that you're thinking of. And this obviously comes across in the content of this book. You know, it's racially and geographically inclusive, goals that, especially in 2020 news cycle, seem to be somewhat at odds in Wisconsin, as we've been nationally highlighted several times. So how do you both think poetry can gain ground in Wisconsin and serve perhaps a different purpose than people may automatically assume as leisurely reading? How can it serve something bigger?
One of the projects that I had as Poet Laureate was asking people about their favorite poem as a way of kind of breaking down a categorical response. I've had a lot of people say to me, poetry, I don't get it. But most people do have a favorite poem. It shifts our thinking. It shifts us into looking at things a new way. The poet Tess Taylor said recently on a CNN interview something like, when you read somebody else's poem, you get inside them, you get their rhythm, you get their breath, you get their pacing. So there's this intimate view, this identification, this breaking down of interpersonal barriers that comes when you read somebody else's poem. You see them so much from the inside. And I think that's one thing that poetry can do.
And for you, Angie.
Yeah, I think about poetry, and I'm probably living in a poet bubble, but there are so many poets in Milwaukee and in Madison and even Chicago or La Crosse or Green Bay or Door County. So I already think we have a poetry highway in Wisconsin already. And if you have been going to Woodland Pattern or Arts, Literature, and Laboratory, you are, you know, mixing with poets from all over the state. And I feel very fortunate to be in Wisconsin. There is so much good poetry here. There's so much to write about from, of course, you know, the times that we're going through, but there's a lot of nature in this collection. So for me, poems are a way for people to imagine. And I think of like any poem that you create or you read on a page, you bring your own meaning to that. So I think poems are like portals, you know, into another person's world and experience. And I really think it's important we write our own stories and that we have a record of our lives here because our lives are so short, you know, and poetry and art speaks across the ages. So I see it as a great connector and a way to build community. It sparks things, it invokes things. And I think as poets, we want to connect. We spend a lot of time with this art form, crafting it, working on it, but really it's about connection.
And I feel like, Peggy, this is the perfect segue for you to read your poem that opens this collection, Through This Door.
Through this door. Words follow one another, one picking up the scent of the one before, leaving a scent for the one that follows. They head for the sweets, cookie crumbs on the kitchen counter. They carry what may be more than their weight, carry it back to the hill, to the nest. A trail, then a flurry of words. Quick, quick, keep up.
That's Wisconsin poet laureate Peggy Rozga reading her poem, Through This Door. It's included in a new book of poems co-edited by Rozga and Madison poet laureate Angie Trudell Vasquez called Through This Door, Wisconsin in Poems. You can also hear more poems from the anthology at WUWM.com. And also at WUWM.com, you can just add one more slash and type give in order to give on this Giving Tuesday. Now, Giving Tuesday is just one day out of the whole year when people come together to support causes they care about. And on this special day, we're asking you to support WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, and with that gift, you are supporting the news that this community depends on. Whether it's your first time or you're already given and want to go that extra mile, we thank you so much. And here's how to do one thing that makes a big difference. Go online to wuwm.com/give, call 877-583-0309, or you can tap the red donate button in the app. So please give today on Giving Tuesday, and we thank you very much. We'll take one more break and then return with our annual Boswell Books to Gift list from Daniel Golden. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's been an eventful year, to say the least, and it's getting closer to the season of giving. And what's a better way to show your love for friends and family than a tale they can dive into this winter? Books are a way we can connect with our loved ones, regardless of the distance between us. It's also a chance to step away from the screens that have now invaded the majority of our lives throughout this year and reconnect with a lasting form of entertainment. Boswell Book Company's Daniel Golden spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about just a few of his favorites.
We're coming up on the giving season, and one of my favorite gifts to both give and receive are books. So what are some of your recommendations for this season?
Well, we have a lot of, you know, we have a good amount of books, fortunately, that people keep publishing them. One of our big sellers this year is a book called Thinking Inside the Box by Adrian Raffel, because it's about the world of crossword puzzling. And so it turns out that a lot of people know if somebody does crossword puzzles. So that book is basically, I really enjoyed the book, but it definitely sells itself. A lot of people want escapism, so they're looking for, you know, fantasy or romance, or in terms of thrillers. There's a book called The Coyotes of Carthage that I really love, that I've actually talked about a bit. He lives in Madison. He's a political operative who's sent to South Carolina to basically throw an election so that they can unlock the mining rights in the town. And he's a Black man going into a very white town, so he has to have some boots on the ground, and he finds this evangelical Christian couple to sort of do his work, but they're kind of going their own way. And he's got a lot of also personal problems that he's dealing with. His girlfriend's left him. And so, and it reads almost like espionage. It's all in his head. Language is great. This guy, his name is Stephen Wright. He actually teaches both creative writing and law at University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I'm a big fan of that. So one book that's in a lot of top 10s this year, this is a book called Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. And like I said, it's on two of the major top 10s of the year and won a major prize. And it is imagines the life of Shakespeare's family. And one of the interesting things about Shakespeare is that he lived through, to give it a parallel today, he lived through the plague. And, but the plague is never mentioned in any of his plays. But his son died of the plague. And his son's name was Hamnet. And interestingly enough, Hamnet sounds a lot like Hamlet. And in fact, in Old English, it's the same name. So it's about Hamlet. Shakespeare himself is like a side character. It's about his wife and his two kids, both at the beginning of their marriage and also as the son has died. Beautiful book, recommended to me by Jane Hamilton originally, the writer in Rochester. Just the kind of historical fiction where they're not just retelling history, they're trying to fill in the margins.
Yeah, it's probably not very common for Shakespeare to get a side role when talking about Shakespeare. So that's really interesting. What are some of the other, you know, books that reached the top of the charts this year, or that you know people are really going to be gravitating towards?
The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett was top 10 of the year in the Washington Post, and I think number one fiction book of the year for Time Magazine, number one bestseller, followed up her first novel, The Mothers, which a lot of us liked. She actually came to Milwaukee. That was really fun. Nobody comes to Milwaukee now, but you know how that is. This book just came out at the right time in June and exploded. And it's the rare book that's incredibly well-written. She's from the University of Michigan writing program, but also is a page-turner. And it's about two sisters who are very light-skinned Black women. They grew up in a small town that eschews, is very colorist. Like, the town is almost all Black, but there's definitely a preference for the lighter-skinned, which is definitely a sort of maybe making social commentary on that. So these two girls grow up, and one of them leaves. And it turns out that she is passing for white. And the other woman marries, basically runs off too, but she marries the darkest man she can find. Divorces, comes back to town. And what happens, just really, like I said, so compelling and page-turning, but also hitting best book of the year list.
It's been a challenging year for most businesses, including places where community is built, such as a bookstore, for one. How has the publishing world responded to this eventful world we've been living in? Are there many pandemic-themed books vying for attention on your shelves?
No. It takes a long time to get books published. We actually had, you know, there have been books about old pandemics and the flu, John Barry, I think. I mean, this is kind of weird because after Katrina, I remember his book about the Mississippi River flood became a huge bestseller. And now his book about the flu became a bestseller. There are a few. There are definitely, but it takes a long time. Publishers are very worried about how long something will last. I mean, interestingly enough, with politics, they often don't seem to care. But with general nonfiction, and especially with fiction, they get very worried. I've had a lot of authors talk about, some authors stopped writing, and some authors can't stop writing in the pandemic, but a lot of them are struggling to figure out how they're going to incorporate the pandemic into their work. And when this is over, will people still want to read about it or not? You know, it's similar. I remember this with 9/11. It wound up being in a lot of books.
Let's talk about some of the best books for escapism this year. What are the best books for people to just get away from everything that's going on and dive into a different world or story?
But one book that actually three of my booksellers put in their top five is this book called, they convinced me to read it too. It's called Hench by Natalie Zena Walschatz. And it is definitely escapism, though, interestingly enough, it still sort of touches on contemporary issues. It's about a young woman who works for a temp agency that supports supervillains. And she first goes to work for a very bad supervillain. But I don't mean bad like he's evil. I mean bad like he's a little incompetent. And she gets caught up in one of those rescue missions and is basically, while she's not doing any particular evil herself, she supports staff, she winds up in a hospital from collateral damage. And she starts this, she's a database manager by trade. Because, you know, you need office help. And she realizes, she starts doing these studies that show that actually supervillains cause less damage than superheroes. But superheroes are backed up by local government and police force, and so their destruction is acceptable destruction and destruction for the public good. So she winds up joining up with a much better villain. And by better, I don't mean less evil, but he runs an enlightened workplace and helps him kind of do some heavy conquering. So it's very much, you know, like it is sort of a look at policing and, you know, and what we think of as good and what we think of as bad. And the author has definitely has a lot of interesting to say mixed in with all this action. As somebody who read a lot of comics when I was young and a staff that still reads a lot of graphic stuff, it's gone over very, very big with a lot of my staff.
That sounds like so much fun. If you read a lot of books, if you're interested in comic books, or if you watch those kinds of movies, I know it's a conversation that I've always had with friends of mine after watching it, like, gosh, you think about all that destruction that hero caused. It's just one of those things that has been in conversation, and to actually see that those themes come into a book is really cool.
Yeah, I think this book is for you. And you don't want to talk to her. She's in, we host, Jason and I got to speak to her, and because we just chased it, you know, they weren't touring her, and, you know, virtually touring her. We just said, please, 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 please. And they said, okay. We had a great time. And she's super interesting. On the kid's side, there's a book that I just love, love, love so much called Skunk and Badger. This is Amy's pick for the year, our kids' fire. It's an early chapter book, so it's like 7 to 10, but it's ridiculous that there's an upper limit on this, because I could be 90 and still loving this book. Skunk and Badger are friends, or not friends. Badger does very important work with rocks. As you can, he is a rock categorizer, and he's been given this ability to live in this townhome by his aunt. One day there's a knock on the door, and Skunk arrives, who's also been given permission to live here. But this is ridiculous, because Badger has taken up the whole townhouse. Every square inch of space has a purpose. You know, there's a lot of boxes being stored, and this is, and on top of that, Skunk is so messy. And so there's an odd couple element. Skunk also has, a badger's a loner, but Skunk has a lot of friends, and his friends are all chickens. And the chickens are just invade the space. They're crazy. All kinds of chickens, every breed. And so they're going to have to learn to give, you know, they kind of get along in a way, but then they have a big fight and they learn to live together. What Amy Chamberlake is from Wisconsin. She lives in Chicago now. She wanted to write a book like Winnie the Pooh. And on top of that, she has the amazing illustrator, John Klassen, who wrote the I Want My Hat Back books, which are just spectacular. And she really captured it. Frog and Toad reminds me a little, you know, all those great friendship stories. And it reads aloud well. My friend was shopping at the store today, and she got it for her daughter, and she said, I don't want to read that book. And so they read it. Oh, let's just read a couple of books. And then later on, she's like, when are we reading that book again? So love this book.
And what is a new series you're recommending to get others hooked on this holiday season?
I'm very excited about our local thriller writer, Nick Petrie. He's now on, I think, book number 1, 2, 3, 4. It's either 5 or 6. But what's exciting, the book's coming right after Christmas. He never gets to Christmas because they always put him out paperback before Christmas. But he's his new book's set in Milwaukee, and The Drifter was his first book, and that was set in Milwaukee. But the new book, The Breaker, is way more Milwaukee-ish. I mean, there's lots of detail all over the place. And so it was a lot of fun. And it plays on the old thing about Milwaukee being the machine shop of the world. So some pretty killer machines come out of it. So I'm really excited about that. Right now, you know, the huge series book in science fiction or fantasy is Brandon Sanderson's new book, which, like, we sell him really well. We have a bookseller and staff who's, like, completely obsessed. But just, it's just like the new book just exploded. Like, we'd triple the sales. In terms of, you know, one of the things about series is, like, you don't really know it's a series everyone's going to read until sometimes, like, book 2 or book 3. And sometimes you don't even know it's a series in book 1. So, you know, that's something that we're always learning. I'm guessing Hench, I'm pretty sure Hench is going to have a sequel if it sells well enough. Just like Ready Player One, Ready Player Two, that came out much later. I know Murder at the Mina House already has a sequel because it's already planning our launch for it. and in terms of the kids' world, there's going to be 3 Skunk and Badger books. I'm not a big series person, but I bow to the fact that there are a lot of series people. Are you a series person?
I'm not always. I think I can't count the amount of times where I've read a book and then I come back like 5 years later and find out there's like 5 more books and that it is a series. That happens to me all the time. So it's off and on. I think that my tastes have changed to where I really gravitate towards nonfiction a lot more now than I used to, where I just used to gorge myself on young adult novels all the time. And I would just read them like they were candy. It's this constant.
One of the secrets of publishing is if you have a potential series in your head that you're writing, usually the first book does not end on a cliffhanger. The first book is self-contained because you don't know if there's going to be more. If the first book works, then you're much more likely to see the second book and going forward end on cliffhangers because they know it's going to keep going. So, but the first, that's why you're like, that was a series, because they actually try to write first books both ways.
That makes a lot of sense. And what are you suggesting, speaking of my gorging myself on young adult novels, what are you suggesting for the person who really enjoys those young adult novels and can't get enough of them?
We have a lot of young adult readers, and we have a lot of recommendations. I actually do have this one adult book that I think crosses over. Actually, I have two, not I have more than two, but I have two, like one kind of has a fantasy element and one's contemporary, and they both cross over to high school, I think, really well. And certainly Colin. So the realistic one is called Everywhere You Don't Belong by Gabriel Bump. A book that came out last February. It's set in Chicago, in the south side of Chicago. And it's about this high school student who's kind of caught between the gangs and some police violence. But it's got this, you know, he's got this friend. Is she a friend? Is she a girlfriend? Who winds up moving in with her family when they can't live, you know, when they lose they have some financial issues. It's got this Thelma and Louise-ish kind-ness to it at the end, because he tries to outrun the problems in Chicago by going to his campus school, state campus school in the small town. In The Escapist Side, I just love, as I think it's actually our book that had more like staff recs than anyone else. It didn't make as many top fives. It's called a book called We Ride Upon Styx by Quan Berry. It is set in 1989 in outside of Salem, Massachusetts, in Danvers, which was actually a part of Salem. And it's about the girls' field hockey team in high school. And they're not doing very well, and they decide to inscribe a book of witchcraft to see if they can start winning games. And each chapter is a different focus of a protagonist and captures a different issue, and it's also a different match. And I just enjoyed it so much.
Daniel Golden is the proprietor of Milwaukee's Boswell Book Company. He joined Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel for our annual Boswell Books to Give segment, and you can find his entire list of book-giving suggestions, including some that didn't make it on the air, at wuwm.com. And I'll take just one more moment of today's show to remind you that today is Giving Tuesday, and WUWM is listener-supported, so that means our funding comes right from listeners just like you. Your gifts make everything you hear on this station possible, from your favorite NPR programs to Lake Effect and Bubbler Talk and the news stories you hear every day. If you've never given to WUWM, Giving Tuesday is a great day to start. You feel great knowing you're financially supporting the dedicated journalists you listen to every day, and this is a gift that keeps on giving. WUWM is here, serving you and your community 24/7, 365. So let me give you three ways you can give. You can go online to wuwm.com/give. You can call 877-583-0309. Or you can click the red donate button on our app. Again, that's wuwm.com/give. Or call 877-583-0309. Please give a donation to WUWM today on Giving Tuesday, and we thank you so much. That's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.